One, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dan Novak, Faith Perlow, Katie Weaver, and Jill Robbins. Later, we will present part one of Love of Life by Jack London on American Stories. But first, here is Dan Novak.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine is likely to threaten one of China's most secretive but important relationships in recent years. China has purchased technology for its growing military from Ukraine. Ukraine and China's relationship has come under increased pressure from the United States. Military experts and diplomats say the current war could end a trade agreement that has helped China modernize its military over the last 20 years. Ukrainian anger over China's growing ties with Russia and uncertainty over its post-war economy and government could threaten the relationship, experts say. It's always been a good hunting ground for Chinese military technicians, said Chinese military expert Vasily Kashin of HSE University in Moscow. There is a lot there, and it has been in some cases easier to get than getting it from Russia. He added that the relationship as it was will be completely destroyed over China's diplomatic support for Russia. China purchased from Ukraine one of the Soviet Union's last aircraft carriers and parts of a fighter jet. China has also bought airplane engines, destroyers and tanks from Ukraine, says the independent Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, or SIPRI. Asia-based military experts say Ukraine has long been suspected of selling some command and control systems and other technology used in missiles. Ukrainian technicians have also worked privately inside China. This work is expected to continue even if the official relationship worsens or becomes difficult, the expert said. One traditional advantage for China in Ukraine is generally the security situation is more fluid than Russia, so it is possible to do things unofficially, one expert told Reuters. SIPRI estimates that China has spent at least between $70 million to $80 million a year on military technology from Ukraine. For military technology, Russia remains China's most important seller. But Ukraine has provided some items that Russia can be slow or unwilling to give. SIPRI data shows a much larger Russia-China trade. Russia has provided China with more advanced engines for its airplanes, radars, and surface-to-air anti-ship and anti-tank missiles. But a suspicious Russia has not always provided its latest technology to its large neighbor, experts say. For example, Chinese competitor Vietnam was able to get far more advanced submarines from Russia over the last decade. The technology China's military technicians and engineers have purchased has helped grow China's own design and production abilities. That could mean China no longer needs Ukrainian technology. China was very dependent on Ukrainian technology in the 1990s and early 2000s, but that has diminished more and more, said Simone Weizemann. He is a researcher with SIPRI. There still may be some technology the Chinese are after, particularly aerospace and missile-related, Weizmann said. If the United States is involved in post-war Ukraine, that could also make trading more difficult. Already, pressure from the U.S. has had an impact. The Ukrainian government confirmed last year that it would halt the takeover of a local airplane engine maker by a Chinese company because of American concerns. I'm Dan Novak.
On Ask a Teacher, we will answer a question from Mohammed about a lot and lot. Please explain the difference between lot and a lot. I'm usually confused when I have to choose among them. Mohammed. Dear Mohammed, thank you for making a comment on our website. Firstly, let us look at the noun lot. By itself, lot can refer to a set or group of things that can be counted. Here is an example.
The company shipped 1,000 lots of the vaccine yesterday.
We can also use a lot as an adverb. Like other adverbs, it affects the verb in a statement. This use of a lot can mean often or to a greater degree. Compare these examples.
I go to Indonesian restaurants a lot.
In the above example, a lot talks about the number of times I go to Indonesian restaurants.
Their noodles are a lot spicier than other restaurants.
In this example, the noodles have a greater degree of taste compared to noodles elsewhere. And finally, we have a lot of and lots of. Both include the preposition of, and we use them as quantifiers. We use them to refer to a quantity of something without being exact. These expressions can be used in the same way, and there is no difference in meaning, though lots of might be considered by some to be more informal. Note that in these examples, a lot of and lots of come before non-count nouns. They are referring to the same thing.
In the summer, you should drink a lot of water. Doctors advise us to drink lots of water.
I hope this helps you in using these expressions, Mohammed. What question do you have about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Faith Perlow.
Dubai has opened the dreamlike world of its new Museum of the Future. The torus-shaped, rounded structure rises almost 70 meters. It is held up by an unusual network of supports. Light flows in through the many windows around the building. The windows are shaped in beautiful forms of Arabic letters. The Museum of the Future represents Dubai's continuing desire to be seen as a modern city of the United Arab Emirates. Its political system, however, remains rooted in ancestral rule. Freedom of expression is limited in the emirate.
The museum presents an idea of what the world could look like 50 years from now. The imagined future crystallizes the UAE's 50 years of development from a small sea-based community to a center of oil and gas riches. It was an imperative requirement to develop so fast because we needed to catch up with the rest of the world, said Sara Al-Amiri. She is the UAE's Minister of State for High Technology. She also is the chair of the UAE Space Agency. She added that before 1971, there were no basic road networks, no basic education, electricity network, and so on. The UAE announced last year that it would join other nations in cutting the release of heat-trapping gases and reducing fossil fuel use in the country. Fossil fuels include oil, coal, and natural gas.
The museum deals with the idea of a sustainable future. It invites visitors to reconnect with their senses and disconnect from their phones. However, digital screens and similar media also play a big part in many areas. The museum's digital screens urge visitors to think about the planet's health and biological mix in a city that celebrates riches, high-cost living, and material goods. Al-Amiri said the museum organizers hope to show that progress toward a sustainable future and healthy planet should not bar economic growth. Creative Director Brendan McGettrick agrees. Dealing with climate change doesn't mean that you have to return to some hunter-gatherer lifestyle, he said. People can still invent and build and grow technologically, he said. McGettrick added, it should be done with an awareness of our relationship to the planet and that we have a lot of work to do. The museum's goal is to get people to think about what is possible and to turn that into real-world action, he said.
Visitors to the Museum of the Future hear about a future of flying taxis, wind farms, and a world powered from space. Some projects would capture the sun's energy and send it to the moon. The so-called SOL project would cover the moon with solar collectors that would direct energy toward devices on Earth. As the museum presents it, humans will be healthy and happy in the future. And life on the future planet includes a new plant that is resistant to fire. McGettrick said the museum wanted to create a powerful picture of what would happen if we imagined space as a shared resource. The museum shows a future in which humanity's collective energy project is directed by a space station called the OSS Hope. It is the same name the UAE gave its real space mission to the atmosphere of Mars. Last year, the UAE became the first Arab country to send a spacecraft to another planet. The museum's imagined future also is influenced by Islam's past. For example, one area displays the planets in our solar system, mapped using scientific tools called astrolabes. Muslims developed these complex devices hundreds of years ago. The museum's Arab influence includes a meditation space that is part of a larger sensory experience guided by vibration, light, and water. These three elements were important to life for tribes in the Arabian Peninsula.
The oil-fueled cities of the Gulf that have grown in the recent past continue to change how people in the area live, interact, and connect with nature. It's always important to continue to evolve and develop and understand what parts of the culture actually push development forward, said Al-Amiri. Creating new norms and new ways of living and new ways of coexisting is okay. The centerpiece of the museum is a darkened mirrored space lit by tall columns of small glass shapes. The shapes hold the imaginary DNA of animals and plants that disappeared from existence, the polar bear among them. In this idea of the future, the health of the planet is observed much like a person's heartbeat and temperature are. Entrance to the Museum of the Future costs about $40 for an adult. Dubai ruler Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum was present at the official launch of the museum. It is his poetry that covers the building in Arabic lettering. The building's designers, UAE-based Killa Design, said the building has been awarded LEED Platinum status. The rating is given to building designs that use energy as efficiently as possible and meet other environmental goals. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
Love of Life by Jack London, Part 1.
The two men moved painfully down the bank and fell among the rocks that were scattered everywhere. They were tired and weak. Their faces showed the patient appearance that results from difficulty long endured. They were heavily burdened with blanket packs, which were tied to their shoulders. Each man carried a gun. They walked in a leaning position, the shoulders forward, the head farther forward, the eyes fixed upon the ground.
"I wish we had a couple of those cartridges that are lying in our cache," said the second man. His voice was completely without expression. And the first man, walking into the milky stream that flowed over the rocks, made no reply. The other man followed at his heels. They did not remove their shoes, although the water was icy cold. It was so cold that their feet soon were without feeling. In places, the water dashed against their knees, and both men found it difficult to remain standing. The man who followed slipped upon a smooth rock and nearly fell. He recovered his footing with great effort, at the same time uttering a sharp cry of pain. He seemed faint and stretched one hand forward, seeking support against the air. When he had steadied himself, he stepped forward. But he slipped again and nearly fell. Then he stood still and looked at the other man, who had never turned his head. The man stood still for fully a minute, as if he were deciding something. Then he called out,
I say, Bill, I hurt my foot.
Bill struggled ahead through the milky water. He did not look around.
The man watched him go, and although his face lacked expression as before, his eyes had the look of a wounded animal. The other man climbed the farther bank of the stream and continued straight ahead, without looking back. The man in the stream watched him. His lips trembled a little. "Bill!" he cried. It was the despairing cry of a strong man in trouble, but Bill's head did not turn. The man watched him go, struggling forward up the hill toward the skyline. He watched him go until he passed over the hilltop and disappeared. Then he turned his gaze and slowly examined the circle of the world that remained to him, now that Bill was gone. The sun was low in the sky, almost hidden by a cover of clouds. The man looked at his watch while supporting his weight on one leg. It was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The season was near the end of July or the first of August. He did not know the exact date within a week or two, but that was enough to know that the sun marked the northwest. He looked to the south and decided that somewhere beyond those hills lay the Great Bear Lake. Also, he knew that behind the same hills, the Arctic Circle cut its way across the plains of northern Canada, called the Barrens. This stream in which he stood flowed into the Coppermine River, which in turn flowed north and emptied into the Arctic Ocean. He had never been there, but he had seen it once on a map. Again, his gaze completed the circle of the world about him. It was not a cheerful sight. Everywhere was soft skyline. The hills were all low-lying. There were no trees, no grasses. There was nothing but a vast emptiness that brought fear into his eyes. "Bill!" he whispered once and twice. "Bill!" He stood trembling in the milky water, feeling the vastness pressing in upon him with great force. He began to shake as with a disease, until the gun falling from his hand into the stream brought him back to reality. He fought with his fear and regained his self-control. He recovered the gun from the water. He pushed his pack more toward his left shoulder. This helped to take a portion of its weight off the foot he had hurt. Then he proceeded slowly and carefully, in great pain, to the bank of the stream. He did not stop, with a worry that was madness, unmindful of the pain. He hurried up the hill to the top over which his companion had disappeared. But at the top he saw a valley empty of life. He fought with his fear again and won. Then once more he moved the pack farther toward his left shoulder and struggled down the hill. The bottom of the valley was very wet. Thick plant life held the moisture close to the surface, and the water flowed from under his feet at every step. He picked his way carefully across the valley and followed the other man's footsteps along the rocks, which made small islands in the sea of wet plant life. Although alone, he was not lost. Farther on, he knew, he would come to where dead pine trees bordered the shore of a little lake. In the language of that country, it was called the Land of Little Sticks. Into that lake flowed a small stream, the water of which was not milky. There was grass along that stream, but no trees. He would follow the stream until it divided. He would cross this place of dividing to another stream, flowing to the west. This he would follow until it emptied into the River Dease. Here he would find a cache under an upturned boat covered with many rocks. In this cache there would be cartridges for his empty gun, and fish hooks and lines. Everything he needed for catching food would be there. Also he would find flour, a little meat, and some beans. Bill would be waiting for him there, and they would find a boat and row south down the Dease to the Great Bear Lake. And south across the lake they would go, ever south, until they came to the Mackenzie River. And south,
Always south they would go, while the winter raced after them, and the ice formed in the streams, and the days grew cold. South they would go, to some warm place where the trees grew tall and full, and there was food without end. These were the thoughts of the man as he struggled forward. But as strongly as he struggled with his body, he struggled equally with his mind. He tried to believe that Bill had not deserted him. Surely Bill would wait for him at the cache. He was forced to think this thought. Otherwise, there would not be any reason to continue. And he would lie down and die. As the ball of the sun sank slowly into the northwest, he recalled every inch of his and Bill's flight south ahead of the oncoming winter, and he thought again and again of the food in the cache. It had been 2 days since he had anything to eat. It was a far longer time since he had had enough to eat. Often he picked muskeg berries, put them into his mouth, and ate them. A muskeg berry is a small seed in a drop of water. In the mouth, the water melts away and the seed tastes bitter. The man knew there was no real food value in the berries, but he ate them, patiently, with a hope greater than his experience. At 9 o'clock that night, he hit his toe on a rocky surface, and from weakness and tiredness, he fell to the ground. He lay for some time without movement on his side. He took his pack from his back and dragged himself into a sitting position. It was not yet dark. While some light remained, he felt among the rocks for pieces of dried plants. When he had gathered a pile, he built a fire and put a tin pot of water on it to boil. He unwrapped his pack. The first thing he did was to count his matches. There were 67. He counted them 3 times to be sure. He divided them into several portions, wrapping them in paper. He put one portion in his empty tobacco pack, another in the inside band of his hat, and a third under his shirt against his flesh. This accomplished, he began to worry whether he had counted correctly. He unwrapped them all and counted them again. Yes, there were 67. He dried his wet shoes and socks by the fire. The moccasins were badly torn. His socks were worn through in places, and his feet were bleeding. The area between his foot and leg, the ankle, was very painful. He examined it. It had swelled until it was as large as his knee. He cut a long strip from one of his 2 blankets and bound the ankle tightly. He cut other strips and bound them about his feet to serve both for moccasins and socks. Then he drank the pot of hot water, wound his watch, and pulled his blankets around him. He slept like a dead man. The brief darkness at midnight came and went. Then the sun rose in the northeast. It can be better said that day dawned in that quarter of the sky because the sun was hidden by gray clouds. At 6 o'clock in the morning he waked, quietly, lying on his back. He gazed straight up into the gray sky and knew that he was hungry. As he lifted himself on his elbow, he was frightened by a loud noise. There was a caribou looking at him curiously. The animal was not more than 50 feet away, and instantly into the man's mind came the picture of caribou meat cooking over a fire. From habit, he reached for the empty gun and aimed it. The caribou leaped away and disappeared across the rocks.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.